Welcome to the .2 podcast from Casterbridge. My name is Christian Corley, and I'm joined with by James McLean. How are you doing, James?
All right. Both of us living in a cave this week.
Quite possibly.
Sound, obviously. Yeah. Well, it's
better than it was 10 minutes ago, isn't it?
Absolutely.
We had some serious tech issues there. That was very freaky. Is James sounded like Barry White, and I imagine I probably sounded the same. Cyberman Barry White was the vibe I was getting from James.
Let's see us as being in a sort of Revenge of the Cybermen Voga cave.
Yes.
If we want to give a picture to the listener, that's where we are.
Before I came in the shed office, as I call it. Oh, can't do anything about that. As we get onto shed office. Yeah, in the cave. Do you know what I was doing? Do you want me to tell you what I was doing? You won't believe me. I just finished baking sourdough bread.
That's a relief. No one listening to this knew what you were going to say, and there was a sort of bated breath.
Baking sourdough bread. Not only was it sourdough bread that I made from scratch, I also made the starter from scratch last week. So working. I mean, breaking all the stereotypes this week on the podcast with a guy. And I just had a piece of it. The second loaf. I had a piece of the second loaf, which we baked earlier on today, with homemade plum jam that my wife made before we went on holiday from our tree of plums.
Wow.
Yeah.
It's positively domestic, isn't it?
It is, isn't it?
Absolutely.
Which...
Can you imagine 18-year-old Christian Corley hearing you now?
The 18-year-old Christian Corley.
Seeing that this is your... that's the future.
Do you know what? The 18-year-old Christian Corley...
Would he approve?
...was, I don't know. He might have been interested in the sourdough bread if it had pizza potential. No one knew what sourdough was, hardly, you know, however long ago that was, 30 years ago.
Britain has changed a lot in that 30 years in terms of food.
Yeah, oh God, yeah.
Awareness of food and knowledge of food.
Yes.
Definitely a massive shift.
And I think it started around that time as well with shows like, the end of the Lloyd Grossman MasterChef and things like Can't Cook, Won't Cook, and then you'd get like popular chefs like Gary Rhodes and that.
That's an interesting point.
Yeah. So I think there was that sort of shift there. Yeah. Because I left school and then I'd go to college. So I wasn't at college sort of like every day of the week. It was like 4.5 days a week or something like that. And then there's the school holidays and then you leave college. And particularly the leave college period, there's a lot of daytime cookery shows. I think that's where it really started to have an impact on things. I saw an old, this is nothing to do with .2, but I saw an old Gordon Ramsay thing the other day and he looked ridiculously young. It didn't even look like the same guy.
What now or then?
Then he looked like a completely different...
Okay.
He looked like a completely different man, yeah. I don't know if he's had work done. I wouldn't know.
I think he has, and that's just part of the industry. It's not a criticism.
Well,
just,
indeed, yeah.
Just noticing aesthetical shifts. But,
speaking of people who have had athletical shifts, athletic and aesthetic, actually. Matt Smith, which is kind of what we've gathered to talk about, actually, in the dragon thing, House of the Dragon, the Game of Thrones sequel/prequel. He's quite beefy these days, Matt Smith. I didn't realise. And he's very good in it as well. I know you haven't watched it, have you?
I have not, no.
So I'm not going to give you any spoilers, but he is... It's well cast. It feels similar yet different. But Matt Smith is he's the most memorable character by a long stretch. He's very good.
So do you think, because I mean, in a sense, once again, which is kind of going to be what the topic is here, Matt Smith is actually fighting against the odds in terms of his casting, because this prequel obviously comes as being a prequel before and therefore after the original series, which ended on a very sour note for a lot of people watching it. So he's got an uphill battle to, no matter how good this is, to actually refresh the palate away from the memories of the ending of Game of Thrones.
Yeah, I'd agree
think
with that.
Do you think it's got the potential? Do you think,
I do.
And
I do.
Is he on a winner?
I think he might be. I think he actually might be this time, which is interesting, isn't it? Because you and I have chatted about this a few times, both on and off air, as we say. And you know, Matt Smith's mm-hmm. made a few movies over the years, and none of them seem to have done very well, despite them being kind of quite high profile movies. There's the Terminator one, Terminator Genesis.
Yeah.
And there's Morbius as well from this year. Two. Well, sister.
But he also dodged, strangely enough, with Rise of Skywalker, which I believe he was meant to be in, wasn't he?
Oh, of course, yeah.
Was Matt Smith meant to be in Rise of Skywalker?
I think he was meant to be in it, but... Oh, hang on, was it? No, it was. No, you're right, it was Rise of Skywalker, but I don't think they even filmed those bits in the end.
They didn't, no, but there was a talk, because it was going to be something to do with the Skywalker legacy, I think, was the conversations, but he... That didn't transpire, but if it had transpired, I wonder if he'd have again sort of formulated again this sort of film cinematic legacy. Because as you pointed out in the last conversation, which I hadn't really thought of, his television legacy has been fairly good.
Yeah.
It's the cinematic one that's the problem.
It's really, really good. I mean, you've got Doctor Who, but you know, before that, he'd made an impression on a few things. There was the Secret Diary of a Call Girl that he appeared in. But more particularly, mm-hmm. there was the Billy Piper vehicle, the Sally Lockhart thing, The Shadow in the North, and it's his appearance in that, and its prequel, The Ruby and the Smoke. He was really good in those, and obviously he had the stage thing, and he was involved with the History Boys, and he did the Christopher Isherwood thing after he was cast as Doctor Who again on TV, or a TV movie, and he's done really, really well on TV. After Doctor Who, he went into The Crown, playing the Duke of Edinburgh. And he's made little appearances here and there on other shows. He's in an episode of This Time with Alan Partridge. He's the voice of Superworm. And then there's bits and bobs all the way along. And then there's this Morbius movie, which came out this year, which I mean, I'm not entirely sure what Morbius is. Can you help me out here?
I am cautious because I could... my memory of Morbius really comes from the comics and the animated Spider-Man show. I mean, he's one of the sort of neutral characters in that universe. As we know, Sony's got rights to pretty much most of the Spider-Man canon of characters, and they've been juggling these ideas of villains, and I suppose Morbius is like an anti-hero, maybe.
Right.
Sometimes on the side, sometimes more of an antagonist, as far as I recall, who is essentially, again, another vampire with a slight, a bit like Blade, which, of course, is coming out again next year,
I think the reboot
of that for Feige's Marvel Cinematic Universe.
And he's a key character He's a key character in it as well, though, isn't he?
Well, I think he's had his own titles, but as far as I'm aware, and I'm sure more avid, I don't want to call them dweebs, aficionado, with love of that character, yes. I'm sure they'll be able to give us more in the comments, but
yeah.
I never get the impression he's been a massively successful character in terms of notoriety, because I mean, he sits very much close to sort of standardized legends of vampires and the like, and he has infected other characters in the past. I haven't seen the film. I've not really got any interest in seeing it, to be honest.
No, well, I'm looking at the cast list.
What I hear.
It's Jared Leto, obviously, and Jared Harris is also in it. Michael Keaton's in it as Tombs.
Yes.
People will recall from Spider-Man. Also in it is Corey Johnson, who played Henry Van Staten in Dalek.
Oh, yes, yes. He does quite a lot of those sort of things.
Yeah, yeah. So Matt Smith was in...
Yeah, so just...
Go on.
So yes, he's a fictional character. He debuted as a sympathetic enemy to Spider-Man after years of reoccurring stories as a Spider-Man villain. In the sort of 90s, they shifted him, I think, a little. So he's more of a sort of conflicted, brutal anti-hero, or sometimes tragic, occasionally maddened villain. So he's, as I say, he sits in that sort of grey area,
right?
As a living vampire per se. So he's not undead like a vampire, but he is a vampire. So yeah, I always thought it was a weird one to. This is what I find weird with. It's not weird with Matt Smith. But it must be hard to work on these sort of decisions and cast, you know, where to audition or where to go for, because everything about Morbius always sung to me as like a not a good choice if you have the potential to make choices in your acting career, because you know it doesn't really sing anything. I mean, we've had the Angels, we've had the Blades, these sort of permutations of the vampire. And it's like, what's this going to bring? And also, you know, he's a character really known for Spider-Man. And as soon as he's there without Spider-Man, especially, I think we've said this before, after No Way Home, where you had multiple Spider-Men, you know, the next film in that sort of canon that you want to see is not one without any Spider-Man whatsoever.
Yeah.
So it's a very odd one to pick if it was more of a choice, unless it was just like, this will work for me.
Well, then again, I mean, all the actors who have a profile, I suppose, want to be involved in the Marvel movies, don't they? Or in some way, if not in Marvel, in DC. So you can kind of understand why he's gone to it, especially given his co-star, who's kind of been the reverse. Karen Gillan, she's been absolutely... She can't find a bad movie. She's been superb in everything she's been in. She's made great independent movies, and she's been in great top draw movies.
But on the Marvel side, again, without me taking the mantle of dweeb here, is, you know, the Sony side of the Marvel license has not had a very good run.
No,
bar maybe the Into the Spider-Verse, which was a good hit for them, but the Venom series, while it's done well in the box, first one did well in the box office, you know, it wasn't an incredible film. It wasn't a bad film either, but you know, the Spider-Man since Maguire, Andrew Garfield now has more value and kudos than he perhaps did when those films were fresh. So it's not the franchise, it's not the Karen Gillan going for, you know, the at the time, maybe it's losing its value a bit now. Guardians was a really good choice. But then, to be fair, I mean, Guardians was an unknown, wasn't it? When I heard they were doing Guardians, I was a bit like, that seems a bit out there for Marvel. What's that going to be like? So I suppose she took the gamble as well.
I guess.
Suppose it's just the same as Matt did.
Yeah.
It's easy to retrospectively go, oh, yeah, that was a great move.
Yeah, well, it's the same with any gamble, I suppose, isn't it? You don't know. You're not going to know. Sometimes you're not going to know, even if you do know.
I mean, I saw some videos about Morbius, and I know we're perhaps going a bit off track, and you're sort of suggesting or alluding to it being damaged by initially being something that would have threaded into the MCU. But when Disney saw or perhaps got wind of what it was doing, distanced themselves, and then they had to do reshoots to try and sort of reconfigure the movie, as it couldn't sit so close to the MCU. I don't know if that's true or not.
Right.
But yeah, but then maybe that's why, you know, films are, in that sort of sense, a more risky medium, I suppose, in some ways. I can think of probably 1,000 critics and academics rising out of their graves or houses or caves to come and attack me on that. But
sheds.
Sheds, because, I mean, you know, television has so much money put behind it as well, but it does seem somehow more of a hit and miss still, doesn't it, than a television show, which is perhaps why things that, I don't know. Maybe I'm just tired and I'm talking.
Well, maybe. Well, look, let's just go back to House of the Dragon. Matt Smith.
I'm expecting to say that, but okay.
Okay, Matt Smith. was initially reluctant to take the role, according to an interview with the Hollywood Reporter. He plays Daemon Targaryen, so he, unsurprisingly, he has blonde hair and there are hints of incest. He appears in the first episode to fancy his niece. I don't think that's too much of a spoiler. Panny Considine's in it, and that is something that convinced Matt Smith to take the role. Now, this is interesting, because we were talking about controversy and Matt Smith roles and movies and things. When your casting was first announced, it was a bit controversial among fans because I think they associate you so strongly with your previous work. To which he said, you have to sort of disappear and can't really listen to outside noise. Which is, I suppose, he has to, doesn't he? Because, you know, he has, I mean, let's cast our minds back to Terminator Genesis, which I went to the cinema to watch. And it wasn't a great movie experience, really. It was one of those things that feels like what it's supposed to be without actually being what it's supposed to be. It felt like, almost like a spoof of Terminator.
It felt to me like a TV miniseries. It kind of had that sort of feel to its pacing, like it was three 40-minute episodes put together.
Yeah.
It didn't really feel like a film. It felt far too confused and... But I didn't mind it. I actually quite enjoyed watching it. I think it had enough twists and fun things going on. But yeah, it didn't feel like a confident one singular piece of work.
I think my main problem with Terminator Genesis was the John Connor guy. I didn't buy him as John Connor at all. He just seemed to be some guy who was called John Connor rather than have... And maybe they did that intentionally to subvert the expectations of John Connor. But then again, given what the John Connor character goes through in that movie, having a sort of heroic John Connor would have been a better option. That guy didn't scream heroic John Connor to me. He looked like an accountant, you know.
Again, we're going a bit off track, I know, but I mean, the Terminator films, I think one of the biggest problems they've had is that their castings have been never particularly strong since the first two.
Yeah.
I mean, even, and strange enough, going to Game of Thrones, you know, with Emilia Clarke in Genesis, I didn't feel she worked as Sarah Connor either.
No.
So I think even again, going back to Game of Thrones, Lena Headey in the Sarah Connor Chronicles, I mean, she's a good actress, but she never felt like Sarah. And they seem to have always struggled, I think, by constantly trying to replicate Sarah Connor and John Connor. And I think that, to some degree, creates too much of a comparison for audiences. And thus they start to find it just a little almost uncanny valley when they're looking at Sarah Connor, who's not Sarah Connor to them. And yeah.
Yeah, Sarah Connor, who's not Sarah Connor. Yeah. Matt Smith plays Daemon Targaryen, as I said, and he's got a couple of good scenes. Now, the main reason I want to mention this, and I don't want to talk about it, because we're going to go too much into it, and then I'm going to spoil it for everyone, but he is really, really good. He is if you're a Matt Smith fan, and I know there's a lot of them out there, you should be watching House of the Dragon. You probably know this already. He is really good in it. There's only one episode available to watch at the moment. He's the reason to watch it, I think. He's carrying some confidence with that, and he seems to have the role of, you know, the character to watch. So in the old Game of Thrones, there'd be occasions when even key characters wouldn't appear for a couple of weeks on end. I don't see that happening with this. I think he's too much of a key character.
Do you think there's enough time, and not just time, but quality for, you know, if he did do a return to the show that we tend to talk about, that this would give him that value? Because I think Tennant, so he's been very comfortable coming back, because Tennant's, you know, made some shrewd and probably sometimes lucky choices.
Yeah.
To a point where his career has become stable, that going back to that show has never been a risk. You know, while Matt Smith, as you say, The Crown was very good and stuff prior to Doctor Who was very good. But, you know, the public profile of these a bit hit and miss films that he's landed.
Well,
Would that be something that would make... Do you know what I mean?
I suspect his hit and miss movies have been largely anonymous to the larger public. So I suspect it's, you know, the past 10 years for Matt Smith has been Doctor Who and The Crown and then House of the Dragon in you know, in terms of public perception. So going back to Doctor Who, which he surely must do in the next, in the coming months, if he hasn't already, film some scenes for what's coming up in next year.
But is it also, with actors being so fearful of typecasting, and if you've not got roles which in terms of industry have got the weight and value and a demonstration of skill sets in a successful format. I mean, I'm not for a moment saying that any of the films that haven't done well for him are his fault, because it's not at all. You know, there is a roll of the dice in a lot of this. But I always wonder whether that is, you know, when actors are comfortable to return to previous properties, is it less the public perception, but more that they feel that within the industry that they've garnered enough credibility and strength to be able to be mobile in their choices, which isn't then sort of configured back to people just, you know, in the industry thinking of Doctor Who and them.
Yeah, I never really thought about it like that.
I don't know. I mean, I think typecasting is some, as not an actor, again, I could imagine many actors coming and attacking me from their houses, caves and whatever for this. But I always wonder how much, you know, I wonder how you can verify typecasting. I imagine they can. They probably perhaps from feedback from casting agents and the like. But, you know, sometimes it's just so much luck in this industry.
Yeah.
And you think to get any good role is a certain amount of luck, because it depends on, you know, who you're up against, not just your own skills, but the quality of those who are also auditioning.
I'm just looking at another movie Matt Smith was in called Patient Zero, which co-starred Natalie Dormer, Stanley Tucci as well was in it. Colin McFarlane's in it. I recall mention of that on a Doctor Who website, probably Phillips, the Doctor Who Companion, back in the day. And I'd completely forgotten it existed. It's some sort of semi-zombie movie, I think. I think that underlines what you're saying, really.
Yeah. I think a lot of it is luck.
Yeah.
There is so much luck involved in this. And, picking the right films. I say Tennant's done very well. Karen Gillan's done very well. You know, she had that one show which lasted the season, didn't she? But even that wasn't a critical failure. It was considered quite good. So yeah, I think it's just surprising, because I mean, he is such a versatile actor, and I think one expects him to sort of fly well, and then you see him sort of end up in these films which, you know, don't do quite as well, and you're just kind of like, oh, come on, Matt. You know, it's almost like watching a footballer, I guess, to use an analogy which he'd probably be comfortable with. You know, you can do this. You've got the skills, and you're just waiting for the right opening for them to show their, you know, show their value.
I wonder, he's 40 this year.
Good Lord.
So maybe this is the right time for something to kickstart, because he's got a face, hasn't he? Let's be honest.
Yeah.
He has a distinctive face. He's got an unforgettably, oddly handsome, yet threatening, and at the same time kind of hangdog and downbeat face, which reminds me of Ian McKellen, actually. And, you know, McKellen wasn't hugely famous away from the theatre before he was sort of into his 50s. Maybe the same things, you know, maybe similar time of life for Matt Smith. He can... you know, capitalize on his looks more now he's getting older. And I find I've grown into my face more in the past 10 years. Just looking at it. Yeah, just looking at it in the mirror nearby. I'm more confident about my features. I know that they're not hugely... I don't have movie star good looks, you know. And I think there's probably a time in everyone's life when they realize that, no... I am not, you know, stunningly beautiful, but I there's something there I can work with. And I think it's probably a very important moment in the life of many actors to get to that stage. So, you know, I'm purely speculating here, but maybe that is something for Matt Smith's career going forward.
Yeah, I think that is a kind of truth, because it's, you know, the power of his Doctor Who role to some degree came from the ability that he was very much, his demeanour is of an older man in a young person's body. There's this sort of real dissonance between in his aesthetic, which is both very young and also somehow quite old. And as he gets older, that shifts. And I think, yes, there's a sort of a certain amount of, you know, a sort of unique handsomeness becomes a sort of distinctiveness, as you say, like McKellen has. So yeah, maybe so. Maybe, yeah, maybe it'll just mean that, as you say, it'll be a different ballpark, to again use an analogy he'd probably quite like.
Again,
40 plus.
Yeah.
Yeah. So he did, yeah, so he did Pride and Prejudice and Zombies, didn't he? Which didn't do well either.
Oh, yes, of course. Yeah. Yeah. Which, I mean, that should have done really, shouldn't it? That it was a surprise that it didn't.
Yes, exactly. I mean, Morbius, I was not surprised it didn't do well, but I was surprised, a little surprised.
And
I could have seen it going either way, Pride and Prejudice.
The other thing, though, I'm noticing, looking through these, is the casting in everything that he's been in is tip top. None of them look like they're low budget flicks or anything like that. He's gone for movies where there's good co-stars. Charles Dance is in Pride, Prejudice, and Zombies. You know, it's not some thrown together piece of nonsense on Channel 4. It's a movie that's funded with a decent budget and a screenplay and distribution and everything. And yeah, it's just it is a strange thing. And like you say, there's got to be a lot of luck around it.
Oh God, yes, absolutely. But I mean, at the same time, I mean, I suppose some of the differences in my head between Smith and Tennant is that a lot of Tennant stuff, he's had quite central roles, while a lot of Smith's films, he's sort of been slightly peripheral. So in some ways, the stuff that I see Tennant do, he seems to have a far more, but then I don't know, well, I suppose, it's just hard, isn't it? I suppose Tennant's done a lot of TV, hasn't he? He's kept quite a lot onto the TV side, while Smith, apart from The Crown, has ventured into the sort of more, as I say, perhaps the more dangerous terrain, the hit and miss terrain of film.
Well, we probably should walk towards the David Tennant thing, actually, because there's something I want to talk to you about David Tennant shortly. But I think you're probably right. I'm just looking at David Tennant now. Good Lord. Is there any ends to this? Since 2010. Since 2010. Single Father. Rex Is Not Your Lawyer, which was just a pilot. Murdering Samarkand. Lachlan Macquarie Is the Father. Oh, that's a documentary. I'll try and skip the documentaries. United. The Decoy Bride. Fright Night. This Is Jinzy. The Go-Betweens. The Ballad. Oh, no. Much Ado About Nothing. Playhouse Presents. True Love. 2012. Voicing that. Not a real documentary. So You Want to Be a Pirate. Star Wars. The Clone Wars. Love Virtually. Whatever that is. Nativity 2. Spires of Warsaw. The Politician's Husband. It's still only 2013, people. You know, we can jump forward a few years. There's obviously Broadchurch, and then its remake, Grace Point. He's voiced Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. He's done Call of Duty World War II. I didn't know he was in that. I'll look out for that. I'm kind of midway through playing that. W1A. Dragons Race to the Edge. That's the, the How to Train Your Dragons, that universe. Good Lord, Jessica Jones, of course, the Jessica Jones thing. Dead Water Fell, There She Goes. Good Omens, of course. The Sandman, There She Goes. Staged. He's Scrooge McDuck. He's even Scrooge McDuck now.
Yeah.
Ark Genesis Part 2, he's voiced that video game. Final Space, I've never heard of that. I'm guessing it's a cartoon. Around the World.
Final Space was good. Yeah.
Around the World in 80 Days. Something called Genlock. He's in the Edge of Reality. And obviously, he's made a thing called Inside Man. He's in at least two more episodes of Doctor Who. He's kind of a, and then there's the Big Finish stuff. He's a, and then there's the documentaries that I haven't mentioned. He's a bit of a machine, isn't he?
Yep.
That is incredible. Yes, he's 156 incredible. Credits to his name, and I would say, where are we? 1998. So it's about there. I would say 130 of those must be after Doctor Who. So so David Tennant, it's very different. It's a contrast, isn't it? It's an incredible contrast. But then again, I mean, I can only think of, I know there's got to be more than one, but I can only think of one movie that he's done, which is the one with Billy Connolly that stands out. Well, he voiced the Highway Rat, of course, as well. What we did on our holidays or something like that. What we did on our holiday, back in 2014, which I think is a good film. But I'm not really sure if there's any more than that that really stand out beyond that. And again, there are a lot of video games in this as well. And cartoons.
But I mean, the movie side, he's not aiming for the blockbusters, is he?
No.
His films are, they go here, there and everywhere, but they're not really the blockbusters. And it is, as you say, it's very weird. I mean, you say Final Space. I mean, I watched that, which is a fun sci-fi cartoon, ran three series before Netflix cancelled it, and it just ends, which is deeply frustrating, and a rant for another time on that sort of thing. But his voice in that, as for one of the characters, I never recognised it was him.
No.
He's very versatile.
Yeah.
And he exploits that very well.
Something else I forgot to mention was Tree Food Tom, the CBeebies show, which is notable because it also co-stars Sophie Aldred as the, well, he co-stars David Tennant. Sophie Aldred's the lead character voice on that. Now, the thing about David Tennant that I wanted to ask you about, I want to know what you think. How is this going to work with David Tennant coming back in Doctor Who, do you think? Have you given it any thought? Because I have. I have a theory. But I want to know what you think before I expound my theory.
My brain, as you say, that goes back to the Buffy musical. You say, I have a theory. I think it may be demons. Anyway, yeah. There'll be a listener out there who is thinking the same as me. I haven't really thought about it since we last talked about it. How long is it now before it happens? Not that episode, but the finale.
I understand there's some images coming along the weekend. I think it's next month or the month after. Hang on, we can Google this because we have the technology. Doctor Who centenary special date. Roughly speaking, it's going to be in October. So
in October, I thought it'd be September. Okay, October. No, I have not. I mean, please hit me with your theory stick.
Das ist gut, sehr magnifique. I have a feeling deep inside that, just to carry on these musical metaphors, we know we've seen David Tennant and we've seen Catherine Tate and we've seen the late Bernie Cribbins photographed. They've clearly recorded scenes together, and it appears that David Tennant is, you know, in Doctor Who at the commencement, shall we say, of this televisual feast. I'm doing it again, of the Russell T Davies era, which obviously will dovetail in some way. Now, what I'm wondering is, does the current Doctor, whose number escapes me at the moment, does she regenerate in some accidental proximity to Donna, who obviously cannot remember the Doctor because of the whole Dr. Donna thing? Is there Doctor in Donna, Mrs., And is that the instigation for her to regenerate into a David Tennant bodied doctor? That's what I'm thinking.
Well, we talked a few months ago, didn't we, about the idea that I think I sort of said, you know, that we reckoned that one of the hidden guest stars for this next episode is Donna. Because it was alluded by Janet Fielding or Sophie Aldred. I think it was Fielding.
Yes. So
there was a rate that they were not the only guests for this, but that was being kept. So it would make sense that Donna being there would create a perfect catalyst into the Davis era and, as you say, into the Tennant thing. My only wonder about your rationale is that, again, do we say this? Should we say spoiler? We will say spoiler. So
it was in 2010. What are you talking about?
I'm talking about stuff we've seen that has leaked.
All right. Okay.
So
okay.
I'm sort of saying spoiler for three times now.
Okay. If you say it again, it will appear.
Yeah, that's right. And it could quite possibly, because I'm actually talking about the police box.
Okay.
We've seen there was a shot in one of the location leaks of a Tennant police box, the old Ed Thomas one rather than the current one. And there's been shots of the current one too. But it seems very odd that if he was just a regeneration of Jodie, that older box would be in a shot. While the newer box is in some of the shots. I'm not quite sure how and when the listener needs to unplug their ear holes, but that's the spoiler. If it is a spoiler, because we don't actually know why it's there. And we don't know whether it's got any relevance whatsoever. But it made me wonder,
yeah,
is this actually something separate? Mm. Is it? But then, as I say, the current box was on the shoot as well in London. So
okay. So, this entire theory bases it around the idea that there is a kind of Tennant as a stopgap before Shooty Gat was Doctor. Doesn't it? I mean, that might not be what happens at all, as you say. There could be something else parallel taking place. We don't know. So,
well, I mean, the obvious thing, isn't there? I mean, and it can still exist around Donna because it's of the same period. It could simply be that the Doctor we see is the half-human Doctor.
Yeah.
From the Rose universe. I mean, we know that Davis always had plans to do something potentially around that version. So he's always been in the side pocket.
That was the spin-off movie Placeholder Doctor.
Yes. So it could make sense that that is the one that comes back. And the reason now suddenly it's clicking to me that this could be the case is that that would be a way to explain the aging.
Yeah.
Because that Doctor can age. So you can have an older Tennant and you don't have to justify it.
And of course, we know what happened in the last episode with the walls between the universes being upset.
Yeah,
with,
absolutely. Yeah, yeah. So, yeah. So, I mean, I would probably, if I was going to put money on anything, I think you're right. I think Donna will appear. I think we're both right. I think Donna will appear in the next episode. And I do wonder whether, because I think, even though we don't see it, I don't know, I can't remember if it was cut or it was just in the script, there was a point where he is given by our universe Doctor a piece of the coral, isn't he, from the TARDIS, so he could grow his own in that universe.
Do you know what? I can't remember if that was in it or whether it was cut or not either. It's definitely in the script, but I don't remember.
It was definitely, yeah. So you've got the whole thing to have a TARDIS. So you could have two TARDISes from two different universes. And that could be a way of doing it. In fact, I would say that is probably the most likely because that would just get around the age issue. It doesn't disrupt Shooty in any way. I mean, it could be that they do at the end of the Jodie one that she just vanishes. And then you have the Tennant Doctor come through and there is an episode that works around him. A search for the Doctor sort of thing.
Of course, you do know that this means that this other Doctor is traveling through time and space with a companion and her grandfather.
Well, my guess would be that in my scenario that I'm postulating here, riffing off you, would be the Donna is from our universe, and Wilf is from our universe, and for whatever reason, he homes in on her into this universe, as you say, because the boundaries have been broken or weakened that he can come through. That would be my guess. That could also mean there could be a Piper cameo, which would not surprise me for this sort of centenary period. I could see that being very likely. Mm-hmm. That they might do that. So that would be my guess.
Okay.
Well, I think that would be quite interesting.
Yeah. Well, there's plenty to think of there, which brings us nicely to the end of this week's Doctor Who podcast from Casterbis. Thank you very much for joining us. Once again, we'll be back soon with some extra people, perhaps. Until then, it's goodbye.